What's the worst Christmas?
Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? It's the one you've been waiting for since episode... God, I've got to just look back at these things and see where my last chat with Dave Dye was. So this is chat number four with Dave Dye, and these are the AMV years. And as I've written in the blog bit, this was the time Dave and I started working in the same agency. So there are a couple of times when we can actually compare notes and look at the same experience from very different angles. So that's kind of interesting. But otherwise, you know, it's a pretty fascinating tour through some of the, I think, probably the best print work in the world at that time, and what it's like joining an agency like AMV. And I think what's coming through a lot of these conversations is the uniqueness of each place. You know, it's kind of funny that great advertising gets produced in a completely wide variety of circumstances. I mean, if you've listened to the first chat, or was it the second chat, about Leagues Delaney and then BMP and then AMV, they're all very different places, but all produced really fantastic work, or at least Dave did in those agencies. So this is another chance to compare a context for creating really good stuff and seeing what the pros and cons of that were. So here we are, chat number four. So this is our fourth chat, and we're finally up at the Abbott Mead Vickers, which is interesting because that's where I guess you and I were first working in the same agency. But I can't remember where we left it in episode three, but I think you had just made the decision to go. Having asked someone's advice, they said you should definitely go to AMV. So that was
asking Derek Hassett. Yeah, we get into the new century, which is good. That was asking Derek Hass's advice when I was talking to M&C Saatchi and Abbott Mead, and he made the revelatory bit of advice, which was, why not go to the good one out of the two? So we went to Abbott Mead. And so that's where we ended last time.
Yeah, and I don't know if I asked at the time whether you felt like there were certain... Because AMV did have the better creative reputation at that time, but were there specific things you had been looking forward to working on, or been looking across London going, oh, it'd be great to get my teeth into that?
It's difficult to remember specifically. I remember what we liked about it is that I knew Tony Cox. I knew Tom and Wall. I'd known Tom Wall for, almost 20 years at that point. There were people I knew a little bit at the time that I got to know better, like Tim Riley. I think at the time they'd just done Surfer. Obviously, Tom and Walt had made a big impact on... Because when I first got into the business, Abbott Mead was very grown-up sort of agency. It was quite middle-class, quite... It wasn't like a young, thrusting, kind of place. It was sensible, I suppose. And I think as you get a bit older, you have a bit more appreciation for some of the campaigns like Sainsbury's that at the time think, well, it's okay, but, it's not very exciting. And I think, they were going through a change. I think David was just stepping down. Peter was taking over. Tom and Walt were doing some amazing stuff that was certainly changing Abbott Mead's reputation and breaking a lot of rules. And we knew Tony, who was the sort of joint ECD who had taken us on at BNP. So, yeah, and obviously, The Economist was amazing. Guinness was amazing. They had lots of good work, I think. It was not that hard a decision to make at the time.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because in the 90s, Abbott Mead made a huge change, probably in the acquisition of BBDO, because Tom and Walt doing things like Unexpected really made you look at AMV in a different way. But there was also hiring people like John Gorson, Nick Worthington, Steve Hudson, Victoria Fallon, sorry. And I think that they then became a good TV agency as well as a great, great, great press and poster agency. So they kind of had it all at that stage, I think.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it was a very good department. I mean, again, I was sort of lucky. It was a very good department. Steve and Vic had done some great stuff. one-to-one particularly. Nick and John had done some amazing Levi's stuff as well as other things. Tom and Walt were doing great stuff. And then they had all of the more, the people who'd been at Abbott Mead longer who'd historically done great stuff, were still doing really good stuff. So they had a very strong department. They were the biggest agency in the country at the time. Yeah, so it was good. It's exciting. Because BNP was an Omnicom agency and Abbott Mead was an Omnicom agency, there was a big kerfuffle when we went, because you're not supposed to poach people from within the network. So weirdly, once we sort of agreed and signed up or whatever, we had to work for a month. We worked in Soho House on the top floor in, I'm trying to think what it is, what was it, Greek Street. We were sort of sequestered on the top floor of Soho House with a brief while they resolved the differences between BNP and Abbott Mead, which was great. It was lovely. But yeah, so it was put off for a month. I don't know whether anybody there knew, but we sort of got a couple of briefs and just used to tip up in Old Compton Street, on the corner of Old Compton Street and Greek Street, and do our work there for the first month.
And was it a poaching? Did Peter call you up and say, do you want to come over?
Yeah. I think, you know, we got to the point where, and again, a bit hasty really in retrospect, but at BNP, we'd kind of loved it, but it was very difficult to accommodate to the new system of this much more open, less opinionated, let's throw lots of campaigns, it seemed, at the client and kind of see what they like, and which is fine, and to some degree everybody works like that now, but it was a sharp change from the BNP that we joined. So yeah, we got a call from Tony and Peter. Peter said apparently he'd called us before and we'd not want to go, but I don't really remember that. And yeah, we sort of, yeah, seemed good. Excited.
Did Peter, so I was just thinking back that you enjoyed being a CD of your own work when Tim wasn't around at Legas Delaney.
That's right, yeah.
And what was part of the deal of you coming to AMV that you would have some sort of creative direction control of things, or was that not formalised?
It wasn't really formalised. I mean, it ended up going that way, I guess, and the sort of very much the Abbott Mead way appeared at the time. It was quite a grown-up adult place, and you could sort of do your own thing, and I think even lots of the teams were just, they were almost their own CDs. They wouldn't really, from what I understand, they wouldn't show David lots of stuff. So initially, I can't really remember whether it involved CD, and I don't think they had CDs at the time. I think I was head of art, and then I think it was just Peter and Tony as ECDs. I don't think there was anyone else CD. Was there? You'd know better than me because you were there before, but...
No, not with the titles. I don't think there were. No.
But I remember pretty early on overseeing some stuff, particularly with the younger people.
So how did that compare to other places you'd been working at before?
I suppose as a whole, it felt quite a sophisticated place. It was very assured. And I think even down to the sort of the most junior teams, you know, when we first got there, there was a lot of the younger teams that we would oversee and look after, and I suppose coming from BNP, there was like some of the younger teams were people like Potsy and Jexy and Dave and Ed, and they were like very good and B, really desperately worked hard and were keen, and initially I was sort of surprised that I think what had happened is a lot of you, I think probably in the transition from David to Peter running it, I think Peter had brought in a tranche of young people, possibly you might have been in that gang.
Yeah.
And I think probably understandably they looked at the way the senior people, I mean David Abbott's view I think was to hire very senior people and let them get on with it, which bought him a lot of time to do his own stuff and other things running the agency, I guess. And I think that when all of the younger element were brought in at the same time, they could see the way the very senior people behaved, that hit the pub and sometimes not work in the afternoon, some of them. thousands of ads to, you know, do get one or two solutions. And I think they sort of adopted that way of working. So, you know, I remember, I think within the first week or so, there was one of the teams that we were overseeing. I think it was a Sainsbury's ad. And I think 2 weeks, I think they had 2 weeks on a Sainsbury's, single Sainsbury's ad. And they presented one scamp that was terrible. And I was just didn't know what to say. I was like really shocked. I thought, God, they've had so much time for this one thing, and they've come up with one really bad ad. So I was really shocked, and they were really shocked that I was shocked. And so I kind of had a long chat with them and thought, I don't know what they're doing. You know, at the beginning of their career, they're sort of 2 years in or a year in. I mean, it's going to take them 1,000 years to get a book of any value at this rate. And I think they've been given a lot, you know, from what they would say to me, is they've been given a lot of leeway. They hadn't had lots and lots of ads turned down. And I guess most of, particularly anyone, and you've spoke to a lot of people who've been at Legas Delaney, anyone who's worked at Legas Delaney has had thousands of ads turned down. And I think they just hadn't been through a process of just keep going and hitting your head against the wall and thinking of another thing and another thing and another thing and trying to find an interesting way of doing something. And so that was kind of unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe from my point of view, just because I, as one of those younger teams, I wonder if it was also, once you'd got into AMV, you kind of almost felt like you'd done it. Because AMV, it's really difficult to explain to people at perhaps at this sort of stage in this era. But in the mid-90s, AMV was just the place to work, probably in the world, I'd say. You know,
yeah, it was top of the gun report. It was like it was probably the richest agency in the country, possibly Europe. It was the top of the gun report. And it was, you know, it had everything going for it. It had the most famous clients, arguably, in the country. I mean, and I think that's how it felt. Yeah, it did feel like people there felt like they'd made it, and on some level I guess they had. But I think if you're starting your career, that's a terrible mode to get into, because obviously, you know, there would be people like Richard and John who might feel like they'd made it, but they'd done a lot of, you know, 25 years of good work and won D&D gold pencils, and you could go, yeah, perhaps they have. But if you're just starting and nobody knows who you are and you've not won any awards, behaving like that is a disaster. So,
yeah, well, I think even though there were some amazing teams to learn from, I mean, what seemed to happen, in my opinion, was that, you know, just if you just drifted and you had some work and you'd show it to Peter or whatever, and you're right, that I think it was like with David, where he just trusted you, and it was one team, one brief, and Peter would often approve your work, and that would be okay. So getting someone to give you a kick up the arse was something you actually had to work out on your own. And I think the way it ended up happening was that you'd find that teams would latch onto a senior team to kind of get that kick up the arse, or kind of use them as mentors as well. Because, you know, there was like Stephen Vick and John Gorson, Nick Worthington and Jeremy Carr and Paul and Malcolm and all those sorts of people. And I do feel maybe there were a couple of teams that latched onto you, but I feel like Cam and I didn't really do it until Paul and Nigel arrived, and they happily gave us many kicks up the arse and made our work a lot better. So it was an unusual position to be in, because you're right, if you could coast really for a bit, and if you really wanted to go further, you had to almost deliberately make life hard for yourself, which was not necessarily the instinct most of us have.
And I think it's also one of those things that people don't really appreciate a kick up the arse until a few years later.
Yeah,
I remember once I was at BNP, and there was a team, I used to oversee a lot of their work, and they started winning a lot of awards, and I was creative director on all of them, and it started to turn up everywhere. So I thought, God, they must be really pleased with me, because all of a sudden they were winning lots of awards. And I remember we went to someone's leaving do once at a pub, and one of them, the art director, came over, and he said, what are you doing there? He was hammered. He said, what are you doing there? You're creative directing people how to buy beer and how to buy the crisps. So I said, what do you mean? He went, well, you're always creative directing stuff, and you always got an opinion on got to be this, got to be this. I was like horrified. I thought you'd be, God, you know, that pleased that their career had really kicked on and they'd started winning a lot of awards since I'd started overseeing and stuff. But he was pissed off because his view was, now all of a sudden I've got views on everything. He's not thinking, he's not done a graph showing that they weren't winning much, now they're winning lots. As far as he's concerned, they're writing all the ads. They're just now winning awards. And the difference is, I keep wanting things done my way. So it's unproven that if I hadn't have, they've written the ads. So if I'd have let them be exactly 100% how he'd wanted them to be, I can't prove that they wouldn't win awards because they weren't ever made. So it was quite eye-opening for me, because you think, well, yeah, he doesn't see my involvement in it. I don't know whether he'd look back now and think that was quite helpful, but yeah, I don't think the people who give you a kick up the arse generally get appreciated till a few years later. I don't know how it was for you when Paul and Nigel started regularly kicking you up the arse.
Well, we were asking for the kicking up the arse at that stage, so that was all right. But there was also a point where I was given a kick up the arse when Peter separated me and Paul and put us together with Cam and Cam. I remember we had a little two-week window where Paul and I still were working together, and I'd done no Economist ads up till then, and in that two-week window, we did two. So it felt like, oh, the fire under your ass was suddenly, yeah, Jesus Christ. Amazing, yeah. And then you realise, you know, if you do put the hours in and the effort in, you get the results out. But it's then you've got to regenerate that again and again and again. And some people are into that and good at that, and some people aren't. So, you know, that might be how it went.
I don't know whether, do you think arse kicking is as popular as it used to be?
Well, I don't know.
I guess it's a little bit more, it's just generally a bit more, people are a bit more sensitive and it's not as, you know, they're not as harsh as they once were. I don't know if that's the case, but
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think it's probably tied into a lot of other things where, I mean, you know, it felt like the rewards and the glamour and the whatever it is of advertising possibly was bigger in those days. And when you're going, hey, you've got five banner ads and a sort of social media tweet to do, you know, the kicking up the arse may not be quite as good as, hey, there might be a 90-second Stellar ad you're making with Jonathan Glazer. And I think perhaps the way that the business is diffused has left people a little bit less receptive to kicking up the arse, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe. Well, it feels like even, say, with DNAD now, that everyone wins a pencil. It seems so, yeah. It seems so unfair that only, you know, 20 people win pencils on the night. Let's give everyone a pencil so that everyone's really happy. You know, on one level, it used to be not getting into DNAD or it's like a kick up the arse, you know. Whereas now you seem to get some sort of goodie bag or prize, whatever happens. But, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting point because, you know, what made DNAD so special is they were, say, let's call it press, poster, TV, radio, and maybe they gave 10 or 20 pencils a year. And then when you went to someone's office and you saw they had four or five pencils, you're like, Jesus Christ, that's amazing. Now there's like digital craft cinematography or there's social media, this or that. And I'm not saying any of those are not worthy or anything, but that just means that now there are floating around 200 or 300 pencils a year. Yeah. Plus wooden pencils for just getting in the book. I'm almost, I'm kind of ashamed of the idea that, you know, okay, you got in the book, here's a wooden pencil, like a participation trophy. Even though it's an achievement, I just think, like, really? It's so much more special when there's only the pencils to win. So, you know, that's my view on it.
Yeah,
so you were at Soho House for a while. Were you doing the Royal Academy campaign there?
Brief, which was a lovely first brief to get, yeah.
And I mean, was it weird working in Soho House, or was it just, hey, great?
It was lovely. No, it was great. I mean, we didn't know enough to be worried about it. We just thought, well, let them sort out what they're sorting out. We're ordering cappuccinos and doodling ideas for the Royal Academy, so it was lovely. And we did something we liked, which sort of been copied a lot. I'm not saying we were the first to do it, but it's certainly been copied a lot since, which was a sort of boxing thing.
Yeah.
Because we just had this thing, I think it had come from David Abbott, the brief, which is that normally the Royal Academy of Art would have an exhibition and it would be on
Pissarro or, you know, Picasso, whoever, and the posters were pretty easy to do. You get a big picture from Picasso and you put Picasso and the date, job done. And this was the sort of, for an exhibition that was called Art at the Crossroads. And when they explained it to us, they said it was all about the year 1900, when there was all these different movements and all these different famous artists doing different things. And, you know, it was a sort of interesting year. There was a lot of contradictory stuff going on. And we kind of had this slightly childish idea that you know, we just thought, well, I wonder who was the best. I wonder who thought they were the best out of this lot, you know. So we thought, who was the best out of, say, Picasso or Kandinsky or, you know, there was loads of them. So we did them like sort of spoof boxing posters. And I remember coming in, it was a sort of weird one, actually. We came in to talk through the idea, and because David, I think, had been given the brief because he knew someone at Royal Academy of Art, and because he was in the process of leaving, and I possibly suspect, because I was sort of coming in as head of art, and obviously his partner Ron had been head of art, and I don't know if there's any issue there, but he was the most unlike him that I'd heard or experienced since. So he said, we showed him the stuff, given that his general way of working was to sort of trust people, and it was the first thing we did there, and he said, yeah, maybe there's something in it. It needs work. Mm. Maybe I could help you. If I've got time, I'll help you solve it or sort it out. I think, God, that seems very harsh. He said, yeah, I don't know. If I can find time, I'll help you solve it. So I don't know what was happening there, because all the people I know who worked for him, that's not how he was. And then I was fortunate enough to work with him after that, did some stuff with him, and he certainly wasn't like that. So I don't know whether it was just a sort of awkward period of him exiting the door, and I don't know whether he thought some young kid who's replacing Ron, who, I don't know, it was a bit awkward. But anyway, he never got back to us, and we sort of ended up making it. And I think one of the things that was sort of an interesting introduction to me, to Abbott Mead, is whereas I'd been at places like particularly Simon's Palmer, where spoofing things or doing something in a particular genre was in there, was you did that a lot. Abbott Mead, they weren't set up to do that. So looking, you know, researching old boxing posters and looking for the fonts and the way they did things, there was sort of no system for that. And in retrospect, most of their work was very much, you know, Volvo was the Volvo style. There wasn't much mimicry or spoofing or,
yeah,
you know, playing off genres. So it was really tough initially to try and pull that together. But, yeah, I think people like Joe Hoser, who was great, just wasn't used to doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, and when did you bring Dave Wakefield in then?
Well, I did consider asking Dave to help us with that. He would have been the perfect guy, but I thought my first job, ask my old head of time to freelance on it, would probably be politically wrong. So I can't remember. I think within about 6 months, I mean, in retrospect, it's amazing that they let me do that, because it's another cost, and they had a head of time. But I mean, I think Dave is an exceptional person, and I think probably within about 6 months, I think he came in.
Right. And I don't know the order of what happened, you know, at which time. I just remember you guys were in one office, then you were in another office. Maybe then you were in another office. I don't know which one. But can you remember the specific order of campaigns? Because there was obviously a lot of really great Economist stuff. There's a lot of really cool Volvo and Guinness stuff. RSPCA.
I don't know, really. I remember initially my first introduction to the Economist was Peter and Tony asking me to come and judge the Economist work. So I think, you know, it was a sort of batch of work. It was an open brief to all the agency. Everybody would sort of drop, I think they would drop their stuff to the secretary, who would round it all up, and then Peter presumably would see it. But then when Tony turned up, Peter and Tony would see it, but Tony had only just got there. And then I turned up and they said, oh, why don't you go through this work? with us. So there was a big, massive stack of paper, and it just felt awkward to me because Peter and Tony didn't really know each other very well at that point. So my memory of it is just going through about 120 ads, me not liking many. Just an awkward, I just felt, God, I feel like the miserable guy at the party, you know, they're going, oh, this, what do you buy this? Quite like that. It just seems like a bit of a pun to me. And it just made me feel awkward, you know, because they seem to be jollily getting on with it. And I thought, oh, it's just awkward. I don't, you know, it's not many that I love. I think, you know, and I think the Economist campaign for me, at that year, it was about 15 years in. You know, it had been really set up. There'd been some amazing ads. But if you're doing 30-odd a year, there wasn't five great ones a year, which is not a great percentage. There was, like, one, two. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed like bad odds to me. So I said to Peter, look, I don't really want to do that. It just felt a bit awkward. You know, perhaps you should do it. And then he said, actually, why don't we do it a different way? Why don't you just run it? Why don't we step out of it and you do it? Which was great. So pretty soon I was kind of looking after that, which I sort of thought I'll do it a different way. Instead of this sort of secretive way where the work is dropped off to the secretary, it's looked at behind closed doors, and then the results were sent out on an email. This is what's got through. I thought I'll do it like Simon Palmer, where you pin, if you need eight, you pin the best eight you have at any given time on the wall. And if they're not great, they're not great. But everybody knows where they are. They know what they've got to beat. And then also you would give people feedback as and when. So the downside of handing them in and then finding out what's been picked is that if you go to the creative director, so I've got this, he may be able to say, there's something interesting there, but not that, or that's a bit cliched, or maybe more visual, or whatever the feedback. You could give them feedback, and sometimes that feedback could improve it a lot, you know, rather than just drop them in. So that system seemed really good. So I pinned them on my wall. I said, look, I've talked to anyone live in real time about it, which seemed fine until sometimes people would turn up at my door with a bunch of scrap paper that seemed the same age as my dad. And you think, oh, it's slightly awkward. And some of them had done really great Economist ads in the past. So at that point, I'd done no Economist ads, about to tell them where they're going right and wrong in real time. I hadn't really thought that through. And it was, you know, it was slightly awkward. So I'd see, say, Richard and John would come in, having done one pencils on it, having done, you know, dozens of Economist ads. Anyway, I kind of did that, got my bunch together that I liked. I think initially I just thought it'd be interesting to, I thought 15 years in, the downside of the Economist is you would see a post at the end of the road, red. The upside is you think, that's an Economist poster, so it's amazing branding. The downside is, before you read it, you think it's going to say some clever thing, whatever. So it's still better than most on the street, but you think it's a shame there can't be just a bit more surprise or a bit more energy or a bit more something. A bit like when we used to work on Nike, you know, they kind of continually chopped up and refreshed things, you know. So I think the first batch, you know, me and Sean tried to do, in fact we did, a Venn campaign, Venn diagrams. So we thought, if there's one circle is red, one circle is another colour, and in the red circle it would say Reads the Economist, in the other colour, let's say blue, it would say something, and the combination of those two things would equal whatever the cross-section. I thought, well, that would be good, because it's sort of still very well branded, but it's slightly fresher, and we could sort of break it up each time, do sort of almost mini campaigns, maybe it'd be Venn this time, and, you know, who knows, whatever next time, and I think that was going to happen, and I think they got cold feet, the agency got cold feet. I think Andrew Robinson, and in retrospect, he was probably right, said, I'm not sure it's right to move so far away. I think that The Economist was David's gift to the agency. I remember him saying. So at the time, I saw 8 posters go down the plug already, so I didn't really agree. In retrospect, he might have been right. I don't know. So I think we did run. We ended up running the Venn campaign as a sort of mini campaign, as a sort of sub campaign. I think they run on tubes or something. Yeah, so that's the first thing we did, that sort of mini campaign.
It's interesting about The Economist and the way it was viewed, because I remember when I was at YNR, there was, and this was in 96, 97, there was already an antipathy from some of the people in the creative department about, oh, fucking Economist again. And you kind of did feel like that at that point it had been like 8 years old maybe, and you're like, God, how many more Economist ads are going to be? And then at various points it went through another little renaissance. I think when you guys took it on and when Nigel and Paul took it on, it sort of had another little blip, and it would win best poster campaign at the Campaign Poster Awards and whatever. So it was really difficult. I think there was a need to refresh it, but at the same time, there weren't really better things around. Like, it was still an amazing poster campaign when you looked at some of the executions. So it must have been hard to balance those two things.
Well, I think it's, you know, I've been lucky enough to work on Volkswagen, Nike, The Economist, lots of the top campaigns in the country ever, really, in terms of clients. And the myth is that it's easy. You know, you get a certain benefit that generally the clients are perhaps a bit more open to creative work. They've got a history of, you know, they've got certain styles and things that make it slightly easier. They're within agencies that have a bit of trust. There are certain things that make it easier. But the downside is, you know, if you're writing the, you know, the 400th Economist ad saying, you know, smart people read it, or however we want to interpret the brief, it's bloody hard because a lot of ground has been covered. So it's very hard to come up with, you know, even within Abbott Mead, there would be, you know, I don't know, 25 teams were effectively working on that all year in the downtime for 15 years.
Yeah.
So to turn up and try and do something better than people had, or not better, but just something good that everybody had missed for 15 years is sort of tough, you know. So you have to sort of change something, I think. But I guess the reason I would say, in retrospect, possibly Andrew was right, is that two of the ads that I oversaw, you know, I did lots of stuff that did play around a bit with the rules, but the ones that I oversaw that probably did best were the Jigsaw one, which was absolutely red with a bit of Jigsaw missing, which, you know, again, the lesson from that for me was I used to go home, again in downtime, it's such a nice thing to work on The Economist, thinking, what could you do with it? Be good to do some visual things or this thing or that thing. And I remember thinking, a Jigsaw, you know, if you're going to do something visual, a Jigsaw piece would be good, you know, a little red Jigsaw piece, or two red Jigsaw pieces, or thinking, that's a really nice, pleasing thing, what could it be about? And not getting anywhere, and then turning up one day to find this terrible scribble with no signature or note on it, and thinking, oh yeah, that's a good way to use it. Got it made up, couldn't find out who'd done it, asked around, nobody seemed to have done it. This little scribbly, you know, this terrible scribble turns into a finished up poster. People start saying, oh, that's nice. Not, oh, that's great, it's going to win a bit. Just, that's cool. And then it gains momentum. And we couldn't find out who'd done it. It turned out to be Matthew. But it's almost, I suppose the learning for me, which is that a couple of times, you think, if you can get to a Jigsaw piece, how can you not get to that? It's so obvious. You know, it's like millimetres away.
Yeah.
But didn't do it. And then the other one that I think got Poster of the Year was in one of those sort of desperation, you know, we need 10 posters. I've got to present tomorrow. We've only got 7. I went round to lots of the teams and said, look, have you got anything that you really liked that was rejected, or, I don't know, the client rejected, or David Abbott rejected, or anything, have you got anything in the bottom drawer that you like? And I went to Tony and Mike, who said, oh, well, there was one we really liked, but the client wouldn't buy it. David Abbott always liked it, but I said, well, that's a good start. What is it? So they got out a scribble of the a very long headline. You know, the best posters have this many words and blah blah blah, but it's for Connacht Street. So I said, great, that seems good, let's do that. Let's cut a few words. I said, why did they reject it? So they said, oh, it's too long, ironically. So I said, well, let's cut a few words so it's not quite as long and represent it. We'll represent it mocked up. So we represented it mocked up. It ran and won gold, I think.
Yeah.
Best post of the year. So the two, you know, under the when I was overseeing it, the two most successful ones were absolutely dyed-in-the-wall red Economist ads, you know, that played with the form. Were fresh but were in that thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it might be interesting to tell other people. I mean, just from my point of view, working on The Economist was like, when you knew it was coming around, what I would tend to do is spend 3 days getting the shit out of my head first, because you have all these first thoughts and these sort of, because when you did it year after year, well, in my experience, similar things would come up initially, similar phrases and similar kind of ways to go, and I had to clear all that out for a few days, and then I could get into places that I hadn't been before. And the other thing that happened was people kind of wanted to reserve an idea, because if it didn't get bought, like that one you were just talking about, it might well be that the next CD 2 years later would buy it. So people would, I remember the Brains one that Tony and Mark did. A lot of people did a Brains one at one point or another, but they happened to be standing in the right place when the music stopped. And I think the Thunderbirds film was coming out at that time as well. So then it got a DNAD nomination. So there was another aspect to it there, where you thought, I want to reserve Smart Cars, or I want to reserve Brains, or I want to. So you'd kind of have it up on your wall and hope no one stole it, so that people would go, oh, you can't do Brains. It's been up on Ben and Paul's office.
Yeah, that's true.
So there was that as well. But just to give people an insight into what it was like in there, you didn't just go, oh, I've got a week, here's five Economist ads. There was a whole lot of other shit going on beneath the surface.
Well, it was. I mean, the ones that people would always criticise are the puns, which I was generally never a big fan of. Sometimes there would be very short, two or three word puns, but they all just seemed a bit, it just seemed very rewarding to me. It just seemed a bit, like a little bit of wordplay. Whereas I always like the ones, the thoughts, you know, would you like to sit next to you at dinner?
Yeah, brilliant.
The loneliest place on earth, you know. So there was the two that I felt were generally weak, which was the puns, most of them, and then the, I'm trying to think, the ones that people would derisively say, they're like, that guy, I think it was a catchphrase.
Yeah, it's catchphrase, there are a few catchphrase ones. But then John Gorse did Know Your Onions as well, and that was a catchphrase one. And I tried to do like Know the Score. And there were all these little, I tried to find out the genres within The Economist ad. Like there was plus something that already exists. So there was Think Outside the Dodecahedron, The Upper Stratosphere's The Limit, Carpe Annum. So that was a kind of genre of Economist ads within The Economist. And you could kind of slot them all into about 5 or 10 different kind of areas. So, you know, if you want to look at it that closely.
Yeah, exactly.
But the other Economist ads you did about the it's not just economics, I think were some of the best stuff, because they did mess around with the form a bit, and the banknotes and the three different things were all great. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think I don't know what to say about that. I mean, I think that it'd been a brief that had been around for ages, which, you know, what you find with lots of clients is that they don't want to say what they are, you know. So Volvo, which I also worked on there, wanted to say that their cars look really cool, which is obviously not true. It certainly wasn't then.
Mm.
The Economist wanted to say, well, it's not just about economics. You think, well, the name's an issue then. So there was a brief that had been going around for a while, I think, that had been causing a problem, which is just to say, we're not just about economics, The Economist. You know?
Yeah.
So I guess the thing, you know, I think you can say that, but somehow I think it depends on how you say it, you know. And I think if you can say it in a very playful, fun way, you might believe it more than if you can try and sort of sensibly prove it. So it was a pretty straightforward thing, really. I can't remember what the line was now. I think it was more than just economics, was it?
Yeah.
And I guess there was two campaigns we did on that. One was showing one object with different spins on it. So that may be an apple. And it said New York. And then farming, was it? I can't remember. And then, can't remember what the other one, but it'd be the same object yeah. with different meanings underneath, and we did a campaign like that. And then the other one was notes, which was quite fun to do, which was just taking the most economic symbol, which was a note from a country, and then trying to spot what else was in it. So when you sort of blow up these, we got a massive book full of all the notes from around the world, blew them up big, and just trying to spot what was engraved on the different notes, to just pick out all these weird little bits and pieces, and it just said not just economics. So it ended up quite a unusual looking thing. I mean, it was quite fun to do. It was nice to do. But yeah, I mean, we ended up, towards the end, I remember thinking we're doing too many economists. I mean, I think we did something like 150 economist ads, and thinking we're doing too many of these. We should, you know, we shouldn't be doing it. And I think one of the last ones we did was for colour campaign, them saying that it's now in colour, and thinking we should, whatever happens, it shouldn't be us doing it. But whoever was getting the brief at the time, I can't remember what it is, was just struck, nothing was going through, and we ended up working on it. And I think that, you know, the thing that, the sort of bit of insight I think for us that came into that, which is generally true on most bits of work, is just the truth, which is this sort of cynical thing. I just remember saying, you know, you spent all this time saying The Economist is for really bright people who really know the facts, and they can weigh up things, and they don't need flim-flam, you know, they're, and you're saying really exciting news, printed in colour, you've got colour pictures. And I remember sort of having that debate with the client, just saying, I don't know why you're spending all that money saying you've got colour pictures. It just seems so against saying how intelligent people are and how wise, and to say we've got colour pictures. It's great news. I can understand why you might want to do it, but to do a big campaign on it. And obviously, the truth was, they said, well, it's for advertising. You know, we want to say that people, you know, we can't say you can now run out of colour ads in The Economist, but if we do an ad, if we do a campaign saying it's now in colour, people think, well, we can run colour ads in it. So then it was about, well, how can we find a form that doesn't take it too seriously, that says it's in colour? So we'll have to sort of either take the piss out of it or have some sort of game, which is what we ended up doing. We ended up doing this thing with different colour squares, with a square of pink, and then it would say pound, or yeah. a square of orange, and it would say agent before it. It was like a sort of, it was almost as if we're saying, it doesn't really matter, it's a nonsense thing, this colour thing, we're just having a little silly game. So tonally, it allowed us to do it in quite an intelligent way. But I remember doing it, and thinking, we've done loads of these things with three, a structure of three, and we've done loads of Economist ads, and Tim Riley saying, no, it's good, it's, you know, you should do it. And it seems ridiculous now to think, should we do it? But anyway, we ended up doing it, and I liked that campaign. It was good.
My memory of someone else who did a campaign that didn't get through that time, I think Tom and Dave did this thing where when the picture was black and white, so they had a black and white picture of a soldier, and then the picture was in colour, and it said soldier and then British soldier, because when it was in colour, further information was then revealed, because you could then see what yeah. the guy was. And I thought that was interesting, because it made you think a little bit about how colour can actually add stuff to things, which I'd never really thought of much before. But I just remember that, and it obviously didn't get anywhere.
Well, I can't remember that, to be honest, but it's interesting when you say it, because obviously, they, you know, an Economist article wouldn't have left you in any doubt that that was a British soldier.
No, sure.
Do you know what I mean? It's not like before, you probably wouldn't have known where he was from. Now, we can tell you exactly where these soldiers are from. And when we were working, we couldn't think of any example where the colour would be absolutely crucial. You couldn't say, obviously, they survived 100 years or whatever it was before that without colour.
Yeah.
And it was purely for so they could sell colour ads. But so I think for me, that was all about tonally, it was all about the tone rather than the message, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting.
How do you say that in a way that sounds still intelligent and stuff?
Yeah, and talking about of campaigns which sort of had a set sort of tone and genre, at that time, every Guinness ad made something look like a pint of Guinness. And indeed, the Guinness at Home ones did the same kind of thing. Did you feel like there had been too many pints of Guinness looking like pints of Guinness, or it was like, we better jump on the pints of everything looking like pints of Guinness thing? I don't know what was, if that thinking entered your mind.
No, not really. I did some of those with Jeremy Carr, and I think I just put those together. I think, I mean, it's funny that you still look at awards books now, and there's still, even though last year's awards books got lots of things, rugby players looking like pints of Guinness. It's obviously a very awards friendly way of doing things. I don't know. I mean, it's a very graphic thing, isn't it? The Guinness, the black and white is. So I think it was mainly Jeremy. But I know around that time there were lots of, obviously he did the really cool Guinness Cold posters.
Yeah.
There were lots of that. So no, I just put those together.
And then there's a big sort of circle, like you're looking for a peephole at those. What was that about?
I suppose I don't know how successful that is, but I think that we did about eight of those. I don't know how many I've still got, but for some reason I thought the thinking was for the art direction, A, that if you just have, you know, it's always good to try and give ads or campaigns their own graphic identity, you know, and as you say, there were lots of Guinness looking like something else, you know, parts of Guinness looking like another thing. And I suppose my thinking, which seems a bit overthinking it, but was it shouldn't be too contrived. It should be as if you've shot these in real life and you've just almost noticed, hang on, that looks a bit like a Guinness in a weird way. So somehow that's ended up as a, I suppose the circular thing is a little bit more unusual, and it's a bit like you spied it, I suppose, was the thinking of that. Yeah. I don't know how much it helps in retrospect, but that was the thinking. It was as if you just spotted this thing out of the corner of your eye, this thing that looks a bit like Guinness, but and to shoot them very real, not too contrived.
Yeah, I think that comes across. And I think it's almost like one where you can't necessarily explain it when you see it if you're not you, but it seems to work because it kind of freshens it up a little bit and gives it a little something extra to make you think about it a little bit. Anyway.
Well, that was the plan. It just felt terribly old-fashioned. This thing looks like that thing, little strip at the bottom with a logo. It just, as I say, I don't know in retrospect how successful that is, but it seemed to make it a little bit more dynamic and a little bit fresh, and the idea was as if you just spied it. You don't necessarily need a circle to suggest spy, but that was I remember at the time that was the plan, that was the thinking.
Yeah. The Volvo stuff is quite interesting because they're very, very Sean headlines. I think it's the most Sean headline-y bunch of work that's in your AMV time. Were they sort of all one-offs, or was there a kind of continuity of campaign there?
No, they were all one-offs, and that wasn't our choice. Because Volvo, you know, they had an amazing history in America and the UK of running great work. And for some reason, they didn't want a campaign. They just wanted to do lots. They wanted no line running through them. So we used the same font. And it's a shame now. You know, when I look at them, we did quite a lot of Volvo ads, maybe 12, 15. And they all seem so different from each other. Some of them are like, but I can't see the benefit of them being so random. I mean, I sort of almost, in a funny way, I almost forget that I've done them, which is not a good thing. Do you know what I mean? They seem so disparate that I kind of forget that I've worked on Volvo, and which is not a good sign. And I can't remember, but I do remember that being a client thing, thinking, that doesn't seem right, but I can't remember why they want to do it. But so there were some of them that I really liked. You know, I really liked the, they are, you know, some of them are very short. And, you know, I really like the one that says, I mean, I just think it's a really good thought that, you know, we believe someone who spends £22,000 on a car has just as much right to live as someone who spends £44,000. I can't remember the exact line, cool as sentimental or soft as, which I really like. There's a few other.
I think the endurance record one's really good because in a press ad, you've really conveyed something very active and in motion. So I always like that one.
And the one I really like, actually, probably my favourite one, again, has come from an absolute bit of cynicism of being briefed on. We need a Volvo ad for golf magazines. Yeah. I said, oh, okay. So I said, what's the brief? They said, well, the good thing is, it's perfect for golfers. I said, okay, great. Why? Because he's got a really big boot.
Yeah.
So it's good for golfers because the boot. There's loads of cars with big boots. That doesn't seem really golfing specific. Oh no, golfers would really appreciate that. And it seems such a ludicrous conversation about trying to. I suppose with these things, it feels like you're trying to. I always think of when you're writing these ads for that it's people you know, people I know who play golf, and think I'd have no chance of persuading anyone I know that's really into golf that this is just the car for you. Do you know why? It's got a really big boot for those golf clubs because they would just think.
Yeah.
You couldn't have that conversation. Anyway, so then they come back and add another reason why it was great for golf. I can't remember what the reason was. So where we got to, we thought, well, there's no reason why it's good for golf. And we looked at some of the magazines, and sure enough, whatever the product was, whiskey, it's the perfect post-golf whiskey because it's blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, it's the perfect... we thought, this is bullshit. Everyone who goes, just because you're talking to people in a golf magazine doesn't mean you have to retrospectively fit your product back to their hobby. So we just thought, everybody must think this is garbage, so let's just completely rip the piss out of it. So then, we spent, had a nice afternoon just thinking, what's the most ludicrous, stupid reason, the most tenuous reason that would link this car to golf, and then did a very crass little silly picture with the
balls,
the car with two golf balls as wheels, and we get letters. They got letters about that saying they really liked it because, if being honest, it was just making fun of the genre that people who'd read those magazines had put up with for ages. So. Some of the Volvo ads I like. It's just a shame they're all so disparate. But perhaps moving about a bit is good. But perhaps we did it a bit too much.
Yeah, I think that golfing Volvo. I really like it as well because it is so funny. But you can't escape the piss takery in number three. Golf 101L next to each other. Volvo 101L next to each other and another O. It's like. It's the most, let's say, irreverent kind of, like, oh, well, I'll do your brief, sure, but the piss will be taken. But anyway, it's a lot.
Yeah, but I think it's good to talk to people like they're your equals rather than they're idiots, Absolutely. And just think, look, we've got this car, it's pretty good, you play golf, we're trying to come up with some daft reasons why. I think you come away from it thinking, I quite like the Volvo people. You know, which is a win rather than tediously trying to link it in. So I think it ends up being all right.
Yeah, that Volvo campaign, I think, worked really well. But there was also some interesting stuff you did for the RSPCA. What was it like working on that with, you know, such an amazing heritage of that campaign with, you know, David stuff and Peter stuff? And
Well, the RSPCA, it's funny, when we talked before about when I went to BMP and they'd changed the sort of look. You know, they'd sort of had this really distinctive look for lots of years, and then they changed it to. It felt like the Chase Awards, to be honest, but so they changed it, and it was the same with the RSPCA. So they'd had a very established look that David and Ron had set up and had been very successful doing. But by the time I'd got there, it felt like it was changing every 6 months. You know, there was loads of work hanging around that didn't look like RSPCA ads to me. So one of the first things I wanted to do is sort of bring back the style and the furniture of that, but just try and reinvent it a bit. So we brought back all the fonts and some of the things that they'd initially set up. And it's funny, when you sort of put ads in certain styles, sometimes they just instantly come to life in a certain set of clothing. So so one of the things I did was we went back to that. I think we did an ad that said that Peter said that would be a good
first had to bring that style back, which said something like, me and Sean had done it, I think it said, please don't make us run our old ads again or something. I can't remember what the issue was, but and we ran, you know, some of the old, let's say it was about the dog license, and then there was these sort of horrific ads about dogs being badly treated, and it said, please don't make us run our old ads again, and it seemed like the sort of perfect thing to bring back. So we brought that back, and then I sort of oversaw a few campaigns that I think they sort of instantly felt better in that set of clothing, you know, and we slightly changed it a bit and made it feel a bit more contemporary. I think Dave Wakefield was involved. So I did a few bits and pieces on that, oversaw some work, did a few things on that. I don't know what else I can say on that, really.
Well, I remember that one you did particularly that said, despite the all-encompassing A in our name, people think we only treat D's and C's or something like that. Which I thought was really cool because it's done in a very, very un-RSPCA-ish way, but it's very kind of nice and kind. And I thought that was actually a very different angle to take that was quite relevant.
Yeah, I liked that one. I think it's one of those things that is an evolution. So rather than completely starting again, that's an evolution of the original style. So it's all the same fonts and stuff, but it's been given a slightly different vibe and used in a slightly different way. Again, that's one we did with Dave Wakefield. It's particularly, he's part of that. He's particularly nicely arranged. But, and it's very Sean Lyne, that. Abbott Mead had just loads of great things to work on. You know, the Guinness, The Economist, Doris PCA, there was sort of endless stuff with a real heritage there.
Yeah, and there was also, I remember you do these ads for sort of things on the side, like the BTA Awards, that one which said crap at ideas. And I remember that was on your wall for a while, and I thought that was really funny. And how did those come about? Was that a connection you had?
I've always been asked to sort of do these sort of industry ads. You know, I started off asking to do IPA posters to sort of get the chance to do something good. And to be honest, anyone who wants an ad, I'll always kind of do it. And so over the years, I've done ads for IPA, I mean, all of them, IPA, DNAD, NABS, what's the planners, I can't remember what they call it, but just all of the sort of industry bodies I think I've worked on. And I think that one, the BTAA Craft Awards, I think I liked that idea, which was basically, you know, a lot of the best ideas are just telling it as it is, they're just truth, you know, and sometimes, and I think, you know, we were thinking the Craft Awards, it's not like the proper one, it's the one that where you get awarded for, because it's a good grade, or the sound's good, or, you know, it's a sort of slightly low rent one, in a way, if you're a creative. So we sort of had this sort of crap ideas, so like, this is the perfect thing for you. But I think I did a blog post on that particular idea because I think I overthought it. And so rather than literally just putting crap at ideas, picking a font and signing it off with then into this, blah, 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 I was trying to think, well, I really like that idea. How do I make it? How do we make it really, really good? So I sort of got into this train of thought thinking it would be great if it was an example of itself. So it was also a very, very overproduced, slick, over-designy thing in itself. And I think, I think it sort of lost a bit of power. So if you'd have just put the words down, crap at ideas, and then just a little line of type at the bottom, then it would have been good. And I think I tried too hard. So we got really good designer Ian Cadby, who worked with me on it, trying to make all this layered things. And the problem is, we come up with this sort of overly designy thing that was a sort of trying to be ironic and spoofy, but what happened is it looked like a sort of slightly over designed crap hat, so probably not too many people looked at it, I don't think. So I sort of over designed it, but I think the idea was good.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting example of, like, everything you're saying makes sense. And I remember seeing it going, yeah, that is an example of its own crime, as it were, crap ideas. You've over kind of done it. But I think you're right. If you had just gone straight down the line and written crap ideas, the lines may be so strong that it needs, you know, to stand out on its own, maybe.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, it's hard, isn't it? Because obviously we spend so long thinking about these things, and it's hard to sometimes stop thinking and just let it go. And I think if people have got 20 minutes to look at it and think about it, they might think that's quite clever, because it's a sort of, it's an example of overcrafting something to win an award at craft, rather blah blah blah. But obviously, who can be asked to sit there and think about that? So. But yeah, it's a good idea. I think there was a few, I'm trying to think what we did there. There would be ones on the National Newspaper Association. I think we did a couple of those there.
You did a graduate ad for AMV as well.
The graduate ad we did for AMV. I think, did we do some DNAD ads there? There's one about Hegsy and booking your table.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That was...
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of, you know, I've always, yeah, they're always, I like doing these things, you know, these sort of industry things. So I sort of knobbed that one up a bit, I think. Good idea, but...
And one of the other clients, I don't think it exists anymore, it's actually really quaint to think of BBC News 24 being a thing, because there's so much 24-hour news now. But I mean, I think that had some other great Shawnee headlines, like just on the off chance something happens after 10 o'clock news. But there was also the TV you did with, I think it was Ring and Ledwidge. So yeah, was that all connected, right, or how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, it seems such a weird brief now. So that is what 2001. So yeah, it just seems amazing to get a brief to say, sell people the idea of a news channel that's on all day, you know, because it was such a weird concept. So you can see now that it's obviously from a long time ago, because it's trying to give you reasons. We're trying to give you reasons why the news would be. And obviously, this is not pre-internet, but it's pre this sort of saturation where everyone's getting tweets and updates all day long now. So we had this whole idea of, it was primarily TV, but I suppose as well, of the news doesn't stop when the bloke says, and that's the end of the news. You know, we sort of had this thing that tickled us that, you know, at the end of the news, which at that point would have been at a very particular time, you know, 9 o'clock news, 25 past nine, the guy would say, and that's the end of the news. And we sort of had these ideas based on, you know, there's some sort of fighting in Mogadishu and shooting and stuff. The bloke would go, and that's the end of the news. And they'd all stop and start playing football and kicking about as if they're waiting for the next news break. And said, I can't remember the line, was that, you know, the news doesn't end when the newsreader says that's the end of the news, was the thought. So we did about half a dozen films with Ringan that were cool. And we did a lot of posters that said things like, on the off chance, one of them said, terrorists don't work 9 till 5. And bombs don't only explode in, I can't remember the bombs one, but basically, so we did a whole raft of those, and they were good to write, because you've got a really clear idea, which is just, it's not all built around the time that the news is on. You know, news is happening all the time. You know, Mother Nature keeps having hurricanes and volcanoes are going off outside the news schedule. And I can remember when we showed the BBC, they liked it, but they said, we want to take out the terrorist one, and we want to take out this one and that one, and in case. So it was all the ones that was linked to sort of humans in a way. So they were fine with saying Mother Nature doesn't work 9 to 5, or whatever that line said. But things like, on the off chance, I'm trying to think what the terrorist one was. Or maybe it was terrorists don't work 9 to 5.
Tend not to work 9 to 5 is what I've got here.
Tend to not to work 9 to 5.
Yeah.
So things like that, they said, well, you know, if something happened when they were up and there was a terrorist attack, then that would look really bad. And we were like, well, Jesus, that seems so overprotective. You know, nobody's going to say it. But anyway, they were very insistent. There were a few terrorist ads, and I think there was a bomb-related ad, and there was a few things. And of course, they were up when 9/11 happened.
Fucking hell.
So we were sort of thinking, God, they're so... You know, have some balls. So what if something happens? You know, then no one's going to blame you. But that would have been up. That would have been a big problem. So because they were up and running when 9/11 happened. And obviously, once 9/11 happened, 24-hour news didn't need anyone explaining the benefit of 24-hour news. And
I think we've gone through a lot of your work, or most of your work. Is there a kind of overall feeling or memory that you have of working at AMV? Was it what you expected it was going to be?
Well, yeah. I mean, I it's funny with all these things. You look back on them, as a really positive. And I think when I was there, I kind of really liked it. We got distracted by starting to think about. Should we set up an agency, and is the business changing? And it felt like the business was changing, and I think, but it wasn't through any bad thing from Abbott Mead. I really liked it there. I thought it was great. There was endless things to work on. There was loads of good, I mean, as you said before, on various podcasts you've done, there was a really good department, really good vibe. There was loads of good accounts. It was great. I think we there were things happening at the time that felt like the business was changing. It felt like the creative was going to be a more important bit to clients, which I think was most people's prediction, particularly with the way technology has gone, is that was, it's going to be a boom time for creatives, because that's the big bit that clients can't get. Once they've got access to data, and, there's debates about the value of account men and it used to be selling, and there was sort of the client liaison, but their role sort of changed over the years. You'd have agencies like Mother setting up where they said, we've got no account people. Certain clients would come in and the strategy would be done. Clients would have access to a lot more data than they'd previously had. But the creative area was the one bit that was, what's that quote? Peter Mead used to use it a lot. It's the one legal...
Oh, legal advantage you can have?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And it felt like agencies would go more that way, a bit more like Mother, a bit more overly staffed with creatives. So we started to look into that, but totally nothing to do with anything bad at Abbott Mead. It was good. It was good.
Cool. Well, I mean, I think our next chat could probably be about the inception of CDD and how that happened, and what it's like opening and running your own agency, because I think everyone would find that pretty fascinating. But that's a good chunk of time on AMV. So, yeah, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Bye.